Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Hey, welcome. Welcome, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday. It's the first hour of our program, and as going on, well, it's over 3 years now, I believe, that we've been doing this with Bernie Sanders every single Friday. It's our Brunch with Bernie. By the way, in the second hour of our program, Dennis Kucinich, barring a call on the House that he has to show up for, is going to be calling in, and we're also going to be talking with a conservative psychiatrist at the University of California. Should be an interesting conversation. And then in the third hour of our program, we're going to be continuing our writing of our book, Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. So, anyhow, Brunch with Bernie. Bernie Sanders, the independent senator now from the state of Vermont, and neither a Republican nor a Democrat, in my opinion, America's senator. Bernie Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
It is always so great to have you on the program, Bernie. I understand that I'm hearing that you took on Ben Bernanke, yesterday or the day before?
It was a hearing yesterday on the deficit in the economy, yes.
Yeah, so what's on your agenda here?
Well, the issues that he talked about were interesting, and I don't think Bernanke is, like Greenspan, a right-wing nut. He's an intelligent guy. But I think it was important to stress some issues that he really did not discuss, and that is that when you look at the economy, you really have to look at what's happening to the middle class and look at what's happening to working families. And too rarely are we talking about the reality that in America, since Bush has been president, 5 million more Americans have slipped into poverty. Millions of Americans are working longer hours for lower wages. And most importantly, the gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider and wider. And today we have the most unfair concentration of wealth, most unfair distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth. This is an issue, and I know you talk about it, Tom, but not enough people in the media talk about. Certainly it's not talked about enough in the Senate, and we have got to continue to pound away at that. The other issue is, of course, the trade issue, where he strongly disagreed with me, and that is my belief is that when you have an $800 billion trade deficit, when we have lost millions of good-paying jobs because of our disastrous trade policy, I think it is time to fundamentally rethink that policy. He, needless to say, did not agree with me.
Yeah. Now, I don't get it. How can these guys look at trade policy? I mean, Ross Perot was not an idiot. You know, he had his charts and graphs,
right.
and he actually built the case. I mean, he did the math, and he said, here it is, guys. This isn't rocket science. You can understand how maybe back then Bush and Clinton were,
right,
you know, hopeful ideologues, but now here it is, what, 15 years later?
It's like a mantra. I mean, that was exactly the point that I made. How do you defend a policy in which you have an $800 billion trade deficit? How do you defend a policy which has cost us millions of good-paying jobs? And then what they simply come back with is a mantra, free trade is just wonderful, and it improves our standard of living. And then when you give them some facts, it doesn't seem to have much impact. The good news, though, in terms of this debate, and what not insignificantly, what this last campaign dealt with is that many of us who in fact said we want to change trade policies, we in fact did very, very well compared to those people who wanted to defend the status quo. So that is an issue that's out there. There's another issue. I just came from a hearing, a few minutes ago on, stem cell research and, heard some wonderful testimony from some of the leading scientists in this country, Dr. Landis, who is the director of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, George Daly, who's the associate professor of pediatrics at Children's Hospital in Boston, very strong on the tremendous potential that is out there for breakthrough research into Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, stroke, diabetes, many other diseases if we can get moving in embryonic stem cell research, and we have a president who is continuing to threaten to veto this legislation, which would provide such an extraordinary opportunity for medical breakthroughs in so many areas. So that's an issue that you'll be hearing a lot about, and I think our job, the good news there is you have some conservative Republicans. Orrin Hatch was just at this hearing, very articulate in defense of federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. It was very strong. Other Republicans are out there. Almost all the Democrats are there. And we have got to rally the American people to say to this president, sorry, there are major illnesses, major diseases impacting millions of people. The scientists want to do the research. Don't stop them. I mean, this makes us, this is not only destructive to the lives of so many people, it makes us look stupid in terms of the whole world, where more and more research is being done in this area and our scientists can't do it. So this is an issue we have to pay attention to. Yesterday in the night, the Senate finally passed ethics reform. Harry Reid appropriately says that it's the most significant ethics reform bill passed since Watergate. My point in voting for it was that it is a very good start, but we have to go a lot further because it is important to eliminate these free lunches or the free baseball tickets that members of Congress will get, and it's important to have more transparency regarding earmarks or the holes that are placed on bills. That's all important stuff. It really is. But what is more important is that we deal with the real problem, and that is the huge amounts of money that big corporations and wealthy individuals are able to get onto Capitol Hill in terms of lobbying, in terms of campaign contributions. Big money is really what calls the tune here, and that speaks to the need for real campaign finance reform, in my view, public funding of elections. So I think the Democrats, both in the House and the Senate, deserve credit for moving on ethics reform. It's passed first in the Senate. It'll go back to the House. But we've got to go further than that. Minimum wage was passed in the House, and all we can say is, my God, after 10 years, it took 10 years to raise the minimum wage above $5.15 an hour. That is absurd. We should have done it years and years ago, and the House did it. In the Senate now, what the Republicans are doing is threatening a filibuster unless they can get some tax breaks. You'll recall that in the last session, they passed the minimum wage, which would have provided $700 billion in tax relief through virtual repeal of the estate tax, which would have gone to the wealthiest 0.2%. Well, they've retreated significantly on the issue. Now, apparently, all they want is $8 billion over a 10-year period. I hope that we can pass a clean minimum wage bill and raise the minimum wage, index it so that low-wage workers in this country finally get a break. So that's some of what's going on.
What do you think the chances are that there could be a change in House and Senate rules that would require bills to stand alone?
That's a good question, and a lot of people ask me that. That's more complicated than it looks, because then what is a standalone bill, and if you add stuff to the bill, is it germane or is it not germane? So the parliamentarian gets gray hairs trying to determine that. But what this bill does do in terms of transparency is address some of the more egregious aspects of what you're talking about. Is that in a conference committee, suddenly a zillion-dollar earmark is added at the very, very end of the game at 3 o'clock in the morning, which nobody knew about. So this bill does begin to deal with that.
Good. Speaking about what nobody knew about, apparently Arlen Specter slipped something into the Patriot Act that is allowing George W. Bush to fire federal prosecutors who are investigating his administration and replace them without oversight from Congress with toadies.
Well, that's right. Well, that's the allegation that Specter did it, but that is reality. It's happening, and they've dealt with an attorney, U.S. attorney in California. At least they fired a woman there.
The one who went after Duke Cunningham.
Right.
Is Congress going to do something about
this? Yeah, I think they will. I think what we are going to see, and I hope in a fairly systematic manner, is a hard look at all of Bush's legislation and actions with which have significantly impinged on the constitutional rights of the American people. I hope we bring them right up and one after another go after them, and where they are unconstitutional, that I hope we get rid of. Now, as you know, the Bush president has already conceded and given up on the surveillance, the ability of the government to do the kind of surveillance that he wanted after 9/11.
Yeah,
he's retreated on that issue.
Although apparently they've gotten, now you can just get a single warrant for everybody. I mean, this
well, it's an issue we got to work on, but
yeah,
I think if we put pressure on them, they will
continue
to retreat.
I kept hoping yesterday in those hearings that somebody would ask Gonzalez, did you guys spy on Democrats when you were spying on Americans? But it never came up. Anyhow, we're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. He'll be back with, we'll be back with your calls right after this, 16 minutes past the hour.
It just don't get any better than this. That's about as good ever gets.
Indeed, welcome back. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, on the line with us. Our number, 866-440-THOM. Toll free all across the United States, 440-8466. And Eva in San Francisco, California, you are live with Bernie Sanders.
Oh, hi. This is Eva Hart. Senator Sanders?
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Because President Bush in 05 on TV said he wasn't going to give a cost of living increase to the homeless, that hasn't changed that I know of. Second, because the homeless want jobs and free from human predators. My question is this. In this history book, it says that the aged, unemployed are not a burden on account of buying power. Can you elaborate that, and can that translate to Social Security?
I'm not quite sure I heard everything. Tom, could you?
I think Eva's question had to do with whether Social Security and programs for the homeless are in danger and what can be done for
them.
Okay,
well,
let's boil it down to that.
The answer is that if President Bush had his way, I suspect they would be in danger. I think, however, those of us who are now in the House and Senate, who control the House and the Senate, are able to protect those programs and hopefully expand those programs. This country now, under Bush's leadership, has run up record-breaking deficits year after year after year. And while the situation today is a little bit better, we have an $8.5 trillion national debt. Bush has suddenly become very concerned about the deficits. For 6 years he wasn't, he is now. The result of that may well be that if he persists in extending and making permanent the huge tax breaks that he gave to the wealthiest people in this country, then his only option, if he wants to move toward a balanced budget, is to go after a whole host of social programs that impact the needs of the middle class, working families, and low-income families. So I expect that in a couple of weeks when the president offers his budget, he's going to take an axe to many important programs that some of the most vulnerable people in our country, including the homeless, lower-income people, depend upon. I think that after he makes his budget presentation, his ideas, his programs are going to be dismissed, and some of us are going to get to work to see how we can protect the most vulnerable people in this country. But if Bush had his way, I would suspect that many of those programs would be in danger.
Joe in Atlanta, Georgia, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Tom. Senator Sanders, congratulations, and thank you very much for being there.
Thank you, Joe.
All right, and this is a quick question, then a follow-up, if I could. Impeachment, option or requirement?
Well, I think what's going on right now is that you're going to see a number of committees taking a very hard look at how we got into Iraq in the first place, and I think we'll go from there. But the first thing we need is that after 6 years, some real questions, some hard questions are going to be asked of the Bush administration about what they knew and when they knew it.
But that doesn't answer my question.
Well, that's the best that we could do right now.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Joe. Dennis in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Dennis.
Congratulations, Senator. I haven't talked to you since the election, and I feel like you're my senator, even though I'm in Louisville, Kentucky. I donated my little small part to your
Dennis, thank you very much.
So But my question is, and by the way, I did see you yesterday on C-SPAN. I thought you hit Bernanke, and he didn't have an answer, really an answer to it. And I think this is part of the implementation of the Star of the Beast program. Now they're going to bring down the hammer part of it, and that's what's going on there. But my question is related to Condoleezza Rice or Defense Secretary Gates. I wonder if you're going to ever get a chance to, ask some questions on, how do they think they're doing a good job defending the country when they've made us so vulnerable to China, and the fact that China is just now, the government's just released that they realize that China is building satellites or satellite killing weapons.
They just shot one down yesterday.
Yeah, they shot their own down as an experiment, so it means it's pretty far along. And I think they've left us defenseless. They've left both our flanks uncovered in the name of, protecting us, and they've done a lousy job. I just wish somebody would call them.
Well, Dennis, we will. Some of us will. And I think the issue here is multifaceted. For a start, what has been extremely disturbing to me from an economic perspective is that while all over America, American workers are being thrown out on the streets because many of these large corporations want to do business in China. I think that is an issue that we really have got to explore a lot more. When the head, the CEO of General Electric, one of the largest corporations in America, says that when he looks at the future of General Electric, he sees China, China, and China, except, of course, when he wants corporate wealth there, and then he comes back onto Capitol Hill to ask the taxpayers of America to help him out. So I think that's an issue that we have to look at. Second of all, there are many people, many conservatives, who I think appropriately so, are concerned about our national defense, our national security, if we are not having the kind of manufacturing capability that can produce the weapons and the spare parts that our military needs. And increasingly, we're seeing the manufacturing capability of China explode, while ours, in many respects, is in decline.
It's, said 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line, taking your calls at 866-440-8466. Our lines are totally slammed. We'll be right back with your calls after the break. My friends, it's the Tom Hartman radio program, The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your phone calls, 866-440-8466, and Bernie, every single line is full, so let's just get right to it here. Tom in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, thanks, Tom, and I thank Senator Sanders, but thanks to the people of Vermont for putting you there, that's for sure.
Thank you.
When Bill Bradley was a senator in New Jersey, staff or somebody came up with an idea, instead of the college loan program, having students borrow money directly from the federal government, taking banks out of the loop, and having students repay the money with 1 or 2% payroll deductions. The benefits are obvious, the biggest one being there'd be like a zero defraud rate probably as far as the government getting repaid, but eventually the program would become self-sustaining as people left college, started working again, they'd be paying back into the system. I look at something like this, and the obvious answer for why it doesn't exist is special interest money. I mean, I know banks make not a huge profit, but they make a lot of money off of guaranteed student loans. And this seems to me one of those kind of foundation investments that we're really being foolish for not making.
Okay, Tom, you raise a very good point. And I should tell you, as a member of the Health Education Labor Committee, Senator Kennedy is moving very much in exactly that direction. He chairs that committee. What our goal must be as a nation is that every person, young, middle-aged, who has the desire and need to get a college education should be able to do so. And that really is an investment in America, because if we blow the opportunity of utilizing all types of the intellectual capital that's out of there, that is in our country, it's a very silly thing to do. So I think you're right. I think we got to get to as great a degree as possible the banks out of the picture. In addition to that, what I am fighting for is to significantly expand Pell Grants, because there are a lot of lower-income and middle-income families that just cannot afford to borrow the kinds of money that is now required to send somebody to college. Furthermore, what we want to do is to have a loan forgiveness program, and that is that if graduates go into socially needed areas, whether it's child care, teaching, nursing, law enforcement, and many other important programs, that there will be a loan forgiveness program established.
Great. Chris in Burlington, Vermont, you're live with Bernie Sanders, and thanks for listening to WTWK.
Oh, great. Thank you, and it's a pleasure to talk with Bernie. And I'm disappointed that you ran for the Senate in the sense that there's no vote I believed in more than voting for you. And now I only get to vote for you every 6 years instead of every two.
Chris, thanks very much.
But I'm a union member, and the company I work for is one of the largest corporate donors to the Republican Party. And I want to know what you think, how we can get union members back into the Democratic fold. So many of them, I don't know if you can still call them Reagan Republicans or Reagan Democrats, but they switched over.
Chris, very important issue. Let me answer it in two ways. Number one, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I think we have to deal with the absurdity of big money being able to buy elections, and that means we have to move toward public funding of elections. I believe that is one of the great challenges our nation faces if we're going to maintain or move toward a vibrant democracy. The second issue deals with how do those of us who are progressives make working people understand that it is absurd to be voting for right-wing extremists? How do we deal with the fact that the Republicans have been successful in deflecting attention away from the real issues facing America's working families, the lack of health care, the fact that corporations are discarding the pensions that they promised their workers, the fact that jobs by the millions are moving overseas, that wages are going down in many respects. And I think the answer to that is that we have got to pound away and deliver the goods on the real needs of America's working families. When you raise the minimum wage, after 10 years of inaction on the part of Republicans, people say, thank you. When you move toward a national health care program that guarantees health care to all people, people will say, you know what, my life has been changed because of what Congress is doing. Thank you. When you provide educational opportunity to all people, regardless of income, and you're prepared to ask the wealthiest people in this country to stop paying their fair share of taxes to do that, people will say, thank you. So I think the answer to Chris's program is that the Democrats need to establish a strong progressive agenda which says absolutely clearly and unequivocally, we are on the side of working families, not big money interests. We're prepared to take those people on, the drug companies, the insurance companies, the banks, the oil companies. We're prepared to take those powerful and wealthy special interests on, and we're going to deliver the goods for working families. If you do that, people will see a change in their lives. They'll look at politics in a different way, and I think they will not be supportive of right-wing extremism or get deflected on fringe issues.
It worked for Franklin Roosevelt. He got elected over and over and over again. Michael, driving in California, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, Mr. Sanders, I just have one question. If Bush does end up attacking Iran, what is it that we the people can do to stop this madman?
Okay, I should have gotten to that issue even earlier, so thanks for asking it, Michael. Let me give you the good news and the bad news. The bad news, of course, is that despite an election, or presidential election in November, which showed very clearly that the American people were grossly dissatisfied with Bush's efforts in Iraq, the direction in which he was taking our country, despite the fact that almost all of his generals thought that escalating the war was a mistake, despite the fact that more and more members of Congress, not just Democrats or independents in my case, but more and more Republicans, are beginning to say, wait a minute, escalating the war is not the way to go. You have a president who apparently could care less about the opinions of others. And he says, I have decided this is what I want to do, and to heck with everybody else. That is a very frightening demonstration of arrogance, and I think that is an issue that the Congress has got to deal with. So not only Iran, which it would be very, very foolish, needless to say, to get involved with at this moment, I think what we have got to do, and what you're going to see quite soon, is you're going to see a bipartisan or tripartisan piece of legislation which condemns the president's escalation of the war. I believe that that will pass. The next step, which is even more important, is to get legislation to deal with budgets, which says that we are not going to fund an escalation of the war. And then the third step that I believe we should be moving toward is budgetary policy, which says that we are going to provide all of the weaponry, the armor, the ammunition, the equipment that our troops need as we bring them home. So we're going to bring forth a budget which will bring our troops home while protecting them as soon as we possibly can. I think that's what we're looking at. In terms of Iran, I think we got to make it very clear to this president that he cannot simply go to war anytime he wants to against anybody he wants to. Congress has got to be consulted. The American people have got to be consulted, and we've got to make that very clear.
Yeah, this guy is not Napoleon. Scott in Herron, Illinois. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thanks, Tom. It's a great show. I think we should all deserve college credit for listening to it. I've been listening for 3 years. And, Bernie, I saw you as well last night on C-SPAN, and thanks for not letting Bernanke trail off into his own answers for questions you didn't ask. But my main point was I was thinking about Spike Lee's film on HBO from a few months ago about the Katrina disaster, and he was talking about trash removal, which I think Tom hit on a few months ago as well, where they paid companies like $23 a cubic yard to remove this waste, and then five levels of profit-taking later, the company that actually did the work got paid like $3 a cubic yard. And is there any way to legislate that actual work be done for contracts rather than just paperwork and hiring more people? And, like, you know, if you're going to profit off of it, which is fine for one level, you actually have to do the work the government's paying for, and if you're subcontracting it, well, you can't take any profit from that subcontracting.
Well, Scott, thank you for raising that issue. The incompetence of the Bush administration is almost unparalleled in American history. I think the American people, for example, want to help the people of Iraq rebuild their country, but we don't want to do it in a way that simply profits the Halliburtons of the world or other private contractors. In terms of Katrina and Louisiana, every American wants to do the best that we can to help the people down there. But what we have seen is incredible incompetence, if not actual corruption, in the rebuilding efforts that are taking down there. So what you're going to see, Scott, I believe, is that, you know, unfortunately, it is the administration that develops these contracts and implements them. But you're going to see, I believe, that Congress is going to pay a much, much, much more attentive approach, and be much more attentive to what's going on there, and hold this administration accountable.
Thank you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie Sanders with us, 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. 45 minutes past the hour, right here in the Democracy Zone. We'll be right back.
It started with the factories where sulfur coal was burned. The atmosphere cried dirty tears, but no one was concerned. Exploding populations, turning wetlands into malls. People drove their Hummers without any kilt at all. Who will be the one? Who will be the one? Who feels that precious liquid rolling down their thirsty tongue?
And welcome back, my friends, to the radio support group of by and for We the People of the United States of America. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. David in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're live with Bernie.
Well, thank you, Tom, and I just want both of you guys to know you're true Americans, and because of listening to both of you guys, I, a few years ago, decided to put my hat in the ring and ran for office, and I'll probably do it again. I had a great time doing it, but
that's
my
great
question is, you know, negotiating with pharmaceutical companies seems it's not going to work. They're not going to negotiate. And if they don't negotiate, why can't we set a law that their patent for that particular drug that we're negotiating for would be null and void, and we'll let generic companies make that drug that will negotiate with us?
Well, David, you raise an interesting issue. The bottom line here from my perspective is that there are a number of tools that we have if Congress has the courage to stand up to the pharmaceutical industry, which, David, by the way, is by far the most powerful lobby, most powerful special interest here on Capitol Hill. You raised an idea about patterns. There are other things that we do. For example, you may or may not know that billions and billions of dollars of taxpayer money goes into research through the NIH, which ends up creating new drugs, which the drug companies then market and profit from.
The NIH being the National Institutes of Health that we pay for with our tax dollars.
Right, and we don't get any benefit from that other than the drug, but we don't get a discount despite the fact that we have paid for the research of that product. There are a lot of things that we can do, and the issue here is having the American people beginning to stand up, telling their members of the House and the Senate that they are sick and tired of paying by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, that it is absurd that many of the drugs that we buy in America can be purchased in Europe or Canada for substantially lower prices. But we're going to need a strong grassroots movement putting pressure on the Congress to stand up to the drug companies. Certainly, there are two immediate issues out there in terms of prescription drugs. Number one, of course, the government should be negotiating prices over the Medicare Part D. If we do that, we can close that donut hole and provide a much stronger prescription drug benefit to our seniors. Second immediate issue out there that I will be fighting very hard for is what we call prescription drug reimportation, and that allows prescription drug distributors, individuals, pharmacists, to be able to purchase FDA prescription drugs, approved prescription drugs from Canada, Europe, at substantially lower prices than drug companies are selling us in this country. So those are the immediate tasks out there to lower the cost of prescription drugs. But we're taking on a very, very, very powerful special interest, and we're going to need the support of the American people to make that happen.
Art in Seattle, Washington. Art, you're live with Bernie.
Thank you so much, Tom. Senator, it's a privilege to talk to you. You said that there's a Republican senator who's threatening a filibuster against raising the minimum wage. Instead of trying to placate him and his selfish interest, label him what he is. He's a hostage taker. And say that he and all the Republicans who support him are taking children as hostages, and you will not be buffaloed, and you will not be deterred from passing the raising of the minimum wage. And the same thing with everything else where the Republicans threaten that they're going to filibuster.
Well, Art, I think you make a very good point, and I think we have to show the American people who these guys are and what they want to do. Now, I believe that the minimum wage is going to be raised. The question is whether to raise the minimum wage here in the Senate, the leadership is forced to give tax breaks to businesses to do it. I suspect at the end of the day that probably will happen. I'm not sympathetic to that. But I think after 10 years, where the purchasing power of the minimum wage has declined precipitously, we should have a clean minimum wage, and we should expose anybody who is not prepared to vote for that.
Evelyn, Roseburg, Oregon, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi. Excuse me. I really appreciate your program, Tom, and I appreciate you, Bernie.
Thank you.
I'm glad to have you in the Senate. I'd like to know, is it possible to submit a bill or something that can put a sunset on the bills that are passed so that they come back up for review and they can take some of the things that have been pushed in into that bill that has nothing reflects on the original bill. Do you understand what I mean?
Yes. Well, the idea of using a sunset, which is a period of time in which case the bill needs to get a new approval and support from the Congress, is an idea that has been used for many years. It's part of the Patriot Act, for example, something that some of us strongly insisted upon as we voted against the Patriot Act. We want it to be reauthorized again, need another congressional vote so that we could look at what was in fact happening. So to answer your question, Evelyn, the answer is yes.
Dave in Los Angeles, we have about 30 seconds, Dave.
Bernie, I just, as one American, want to thank you for your very hard work last weekend on both the Council for Media Reform.
Yep.
And for standing up and speaking to Bernanke and telling him that wages do not cause inflation.
Right. Well, thank you very much, David.
Thank you, Dave. Bernie, final thoughts?
The final thought is that you're beginning to see some changes here in Washington. We've got a long way to go, but we are not going to be successful unless the American people are engaged on these issues and are prepared to tell their senators and congressmen to do what is necessary for the middle class of this country, not big money interests.
As always, thank you so much, Bernie Sanders.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great having you here. We'll be right back after the news at the top of the hour on the Tom Hartmann Radio Program. A place where being progressive never felt so good. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, the third hour of our program. Tom Hartmann here with you. The place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination or maybe, you know, some electoral victories. And I want to talk about that. I am writing a book. And to the best of my knowledge, it's the first time anybody's ever tried to write a book on the air. That's what I'm doing right now. As I'm talking to you, we're going to transcribe this, and it's going to be part of the book. It's going to be it's coming out from Bear Kohler next, well, it's 2007 now, this fall. So this book will not be available for 6 months or 9 months, something like that. And it's titled Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. And we are now, I think, in our fifth week of going through this, maybe, well, whatever it is. And what I want to talk about today is this whole concept of how you can throw people into a future, or how you yourself can project yourself into the future and in useful and positive ways take control of that future for yourself, or in the political arena, the way that we organize our own futures is used by political marketers, for lack of a better word, to create future associations in the present with political points of view or politicians or candidates that can be either negative or positive. In other words, this is like a scalpel. You know, a scalpel can be used to heal or to kill. This is simply a tool. It is value neutral. But it's a very powerful tool. And it is used, and it is used frequently. The Dukakis campaign by George Bush Sr. is probably the most obvious example of the most recent use of it. And that will become apparent to you as we go through this. But let me just tell you a story that is seemingly unrelated to politics about how I, at one point in time, used this whole concept of creating a future to change the behavior of somebody that I found, frankly, offensive. This was probably 10 years ago. I was doing marketing consulting at the time, owned an ad agency in Atlanta, and I was spending probably 30 weeks a year or pieces of them on the road, doing a lot of traveling, going into companies and spending a day or two training people, training ad. We trained many of the largest ad agencies in the United States on strategies of communications and tools of communications. And so anyhow, I'm flying, and it was the weekend. It was the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, the day before Thanksgiving, which is, and I was trying to get home, which is the busiest travel day of the year. At the time, I lived in Atlanta, and I was flying back home from somewhere out west on Delta, and I was going through the Cincinnati airport to connecting, and there was this massive snowstorm that was slamming the United States from the Rocky Mountains all the way through the Midwest. And because I flew a lot, I had all these, you know, I was upgrades and coupons and club memberships and all this junk. And I was a member of the Delta Airlines Red Carpet Club. And so I walked in, and my flight was delayed like 5 hours, as was everybody's. So I walk into the Red Carpet Club, which was slammed with people in itself. I mean, it was, every chair was occupied. And I walk in. And, you know, showed my card and went in. And in the no smoking area, now this is back in the days when they had a smoking area and a no smoking area. In the no smoking area, there's a couple of couches and a couple of chairs that kind of made up this little circle around a coffee table, a fairly large one. And there's this big Texas guy, right? I mean, the big belt buckle, the hat, the boots, the whole bit, sitting in the no smoking section, with this giant cigar, smoking this cigar. Now, and with his feet, his cowboy boots up on the coffee table, and just oblivious to everybody around him. And the people around him, and I sat down, there was an empty seat opposite him, and I sat down in it. And the people around him were clearly discomforted by the cigar. And there was a sign when you come in that says, you know, no pipe or cigar smoking, cigarette smoking only, and only in designated areas. And the designated area was over on the other end of the Red Carpet Club. And so, I'm sitting there, and I wasn't all that horrified by it, but I didn't like it, but I wasn't going to do anything about it until this woman who was sitting a couple of chairs away from him starts coughing pretty badly. And then she says, sir, your cigar, she says, I have asthma, and that smoke is really hurting me. Would you please stop? And he looks at her for a minute, takes a puff on his pull, you know, a pull on the cigar, and blows smoke at her and goes back to just kind of looking off into space and being Mr. Cool. And so, sorry, distracted here. And so she, after a minute or two, she gets up and she goes over to the counter and says to the woman who's running the Red Carpet Club, you know, has a conversation with her. And a few minutes later, the woman who has this long line of people who are like trying to change and their flights and things and whatnot, she comes over to this guy, the woman who runs the Red Carpet Club, and says, with a pack of cigarettes in her hand, and says, sir, I've got a pack of cigarettes here for you, and if you could please move over to the smoking section. We don't allow cigar smoking, and you can't smoke here in the non-smoking section. And he kind of stares her down for a minute and takes another puff on his cigar and blows it in her direction, and he says, call a cop, lady. And she stands there for a minute or two, just, you know, kind of shocked, and then looks around and looks back at this long line of people. And, I mean, the airport's a madhouse, and decides, obviously, this is not a fight worth having, and just turns around and goes back to her work. And he goes back to being Mr. Smug. And the people around him now, I mean, everybody's glaring at this guy. And I just come in on this flight from the West Coast gotten bumped up to first class, and I'd had probably a glass or two of wine more than I should have. And so I leaned across the table, leaned forward, and said to this guy, I'll bet you know something that I've always wondered about. And I said it, and, you know, I tried to say it in a friendly way. And he looks at me like, huh? And I said, I'll bet, you know, there's something I have wondered about. I have wondered ever since I was in high school. And, in fact, I'll bet most people wonder about it. And I'll bet you know the answer. I'll bet you could tell me the answer. And in fact, now this is the future pacing part. I said, in fact, I'll bet that not only do you know the answer, but pretty much everywhere you go, people know that you know the answer. All they have to do is take one look at you, and they know that you know the answer. You know, you're walking down the street. In the future, people take a look at you. They know that you know the answer. And so he looks at me and he says, so now I got him, right? I got him hooked. He says, okay, what's the question? And I said, well, you know, we all learned. I mean, everybody learned. You learn it in high school. You know, the psychology, you know, 101. I mean, we all learn. Everybody knows this. I mean, everybody who sees you walking down the street, and I threw another future metaphor in there of some sort, like anybody who sees you walking down the street or sees you in a restaurant, or the folks sitting here in the Red Carpet Club, they all know that back in the 1890s, Sigmund Freud said, the larger the cigar, the smaller the penis. And so I'm just wondering, is it true? And he takes his cigar out of his mouth and looks at it and looks at me. And I'm now leaning back in my chair because I'm getting from his body language that he's trying to decide whether or not he's going to punch me. And then he just stands up and walks out of the Red Carpet Club. Just stands up and walks out the door, cigar in his hand. And the room bursts into applause. And I'm, you know, wiping the sweat off my forehead. But I not only wanted to zing him with that, but I was sufficiently PO'd with this guy that I wanted to make sure that any time in the future he pulled out a cigar, he started looking around at and all the people around him and hallucinating, imagining that they were all wondering whether or not he had a small penis. Now, that's not probably the most moral or best example of how to use this technology. And I confess right up front. But I'll deconstruct it for you and tell you how it's done right after this break. 16 minutes past the hour.
It was a beautiful day. Sun beat down. I heard the radio walk. I was driving.
Welcome back to the radio support group. I'm Brian Ford. We, the people of the United States of America. Just a heads up, Thursday and Friday of next week, January 25th and 26th, I will be doing this program live from Washington, D.C., a radio row being put on by Talk Radio News Service at the Mayflower Hotel. And Thursday night at 6 p.m., and this is at the Families USA Conference, and Thursday night at 6 p.m., I'll be speaking at the Mayflower Hotel. We'll be doing a press party. My new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, What We Can Do About It. It's open to the public. You don't have to register for the conference if you want to drop by. And then, of course, on the 27th is the big anti-war conference or march or protest or demonstration or whatever in Washington, D.C. So, anyhow, that's the whole thing there. So just share that with you. And after the break at the bottom of the hour, I will take your calls if you have questions or thoughts on this topic. In particular, questions if there's anything I'm not making clear about this. But first of all, with regard to the whole cigar story and this poor guy in the Red Carpet Club, the Red Carpet Club, or was it called the Crown Room? I think it was called the Delta's Airlines is the Crown Room. It's the Red Carpet Club is the United one. In any case, my rationalization, for what it's worth, and I guess we all have to have them, is that I was doing something good for his health. If I could cause him to quit smoking cigars, I don't know. It's me. So anyhow, here's the steps, basically,
is you create an imagination of the future. You project yourself, if you want to do this to yourself, or you project the other person into that imagined future. And then you can define or modify that future. So, for example, if you have a presidential candidate, you want to get people imagining that person as president. For example, when Dennis Kucinich was on the program about an hour ago just now, he said, when I'm president of the United States. Now, that's a great way of causing people to imagine what the country would be like with Dennis Kucinich as president of the United States. It is pushing us into the future. And then he lists how it's going to be different. Then he's bringing us along. Now, the other side will do the same. The old Willie Horton ads, where, you know, they showed pictures of Willie Horton, and then they showed pictures of Michael Dukakis, and it was basically, you know, imagine Michael Dukakis as president, Willie Horton's going to be knocking on your door. Do you want a murderer and a rapist and ultimately, you know, the racist pitch, a black guy coming after you? Was the subtext of the message that the Bushies were putting out. Tragically successfully. Now, to use this for self-motivation, here's a really simple technique that for you as an activist or as a, you know, in the political world, this is a very simple, straightforward way to do it, and you can do this in any dimension of your life, frankly. Imagine a line on the floor, 5-10 feet long, and at one point is present, and at another point is, say, 5 years out in the future. Step into the present. Notice, you know, everything around you. Look out at the future point on the line and imagine yourself standing there. And just imagine, you know, okay, I see myself standing out there and it's 5 years from now and here's what I'm doing and here's, you know, what it looks like. Then step forward slowly across, you know, down that line until you get to that point in the future and turn around and look back at yourself in the present. And first of all, check out that future. How does it feel? What are you wearing? What are you seeing? What are you feeling? And is this the future that you want? Is this the world that you want? And if it is, cool. If it's not, modify it right then and there in the future. Then turn around then walk back into the present. Walk back down the line to the present point and turn around and look back at the future. And it's real important that to finish this, you must imagine yourself out in the future again. This is called a disassociated visualization, where you see yourself. If you see the future as if you were in it, you will feel like it has already happened and you won't be motivated. On the other hand, if you see yourself in the future, you are disassociated from it. It's not as if it has already happened. It won't feel like it's the present or the past. It will feel like it's the future. And you will be motivated to move towards it. And then you stand in that present point, and you look down at the floor at that 10-foot line out to that future point, and notice all the steps along that line that you have to go through to get to that future. Oh, I've got to do this, and then I've got to do this, and then I've got to do this, and then I accomplish that. This is the core of virtually all strategic internal motivation strategies. Most people develop them unconsciously. This is the conscious way to do it. 27 minutes past the hour.
How many wrinkles in a pickle? How many hairs in a hair? How many waves in the ocean? How many crumbs in bread? But last but not least, baby, most of all, why do I mumble every time you call? Because you're strange to me, baby.
And welcome back. It's listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman radio program, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Listen for the sponsors on your local station and let them know that you're listening. They do appreciate it, and, you know, buy their products and tell your friends to. Also, our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, all organic, all fair trade, sacredgroundscoffee.com.
Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, the Organic Wine Company, Eco Wine, 1-888-ECO-WINE, and Purina One Natural Blends, 866-380-MEOW, which is spelled M-E-O-W, 380-MEOW. Anyhow, welcome back. When you're, by the way, when you're, I wanted to, one other point I wanted to add before I go to your phone calls, is when you're talking with others about politics, here's probably the most powerful part of the whole thing, that everything that I just shared with you. And it's really meta to what I just did. And that is that story is the most powerful tool for communication. The way that we know who we are in the world is a set of stories that we hold about who we are. Stories that we learn through our childhood, stories that we learn our place in the country, story, you know, it's all about story. And if you want to communicate a message to somebody, the most powerful and effective way to do it is to wrap it in a story. Because the story will be the hook that their brain will hang on to. People will remember the story for a long, long time. And with the story is the information that's embedded in it. And so if you want them to carry information, you embed it in a story. Really simple. And that's why when you're trying to talk politics, for example, it's best to put things in story terms and future and real terms. For example, do we want to, in the United States, see a country? And they can be negative or positive, by the way. Here's a negative one. Do we want to, in the United States, be living in a country where when you walk out the front door, there are begging children standing there covered with sores and scabs and their hands out asking for food? Now, I have lived and worked in countries where that's the reality. And that's the economic policies that this administration and that 26 years of conservative economics are moving us in the direction of, doing away with the middle class and producing the working poor. We've got 13 million people in the United States who literally do not know where they're going to get their next meal from. So you make the picture. You ask the question, and if possible, there's two other dimensions to this. One is using the word you, embedding the word you, and the other is the use of negatives. And if we have enough time this afternoon, I'll get to it. Otherwise, we'll get to it next week. First, though, Barry in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Barry, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Hi. It's an honor to talk to you. I enjoy your show tremendously.
Thank you, Barry.
And I really love that anecdote you just told about this cigar-smoking Texan, you know, defying everybody.
He was like out of central casting. I mean, this guy. He was so into his, well, don't get me started.
Yeah. So. Anyway, as you were talking about this guy, it just flashed on me that Bush is just like this guy on a large scale.
Yeah.
Here he is defying, you know, the American public who voted in a Democratic controlled Congress and defying Congress, you know, in all our desires to bring our troops back from Iraq and end this mess over there. And, you know, he just sort of shoving his hand in everybody's face.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah. I remember seeing a bumper sticker that said, quick, somebody get G.W. Bush a BJ so we can impeach him. And I think that there's actually another level of truth to that, and that is that, and you know, without getting too psychobabbly or woo-woo, and that is that maybe what we're seeing here is George's feelings of incompetence and impotence throughout his life being acted out as the big bully war maker.
Yes.
And Napoleon, you know, people talk about that being the case with Napoleon and other dictators in history, warmongers in history, that they had a background that kind of led them to that, and you wonder about it. So.
Yeah, well, I was thinking along those lines. I was thinking maybe somebody should approach him and ask him about the size of his penis.
Yeah, well, I doubt they would end up in Guantanamo. That's the problem. See, that's how he would demonstrate it. I mean, that's the thing. The whole thing. This gets back to testosterone is the most dangerous drug in the world. Barry, thank you for the call. Gene in San Francisco. Hey, Gene.
Oh, hi, Tom. What you guys are just talking about made me remember that our governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, here in California, has erected a tent to smoke at the Capitol building in Sacramento.
Oh, interesting.
His cigars, because he's an avid cigar smoker, and it's illegal, of course, on the grounds, but he has erected this tent anyway. But what I'm talking
interesting
about...
use of language there, Gene.
I'm excited about your new book taking shape here before my very ears.
Me too.
I get so disgusted every time I remember that so many valuable psychological discoveries are kept nearly like proprietary information for the advertising marketing industry, the government, the psychological profession. And these should be things that people know, people can use to communicate and better their lives, like you're suggesting with this book.
Well, thank you, Jean. Yeah, and that's what I'm trying to do.
And
I'm sorry.
What I was wanted to ask was, can you include a chapter, because I think a great example of this is the story of Freud's nephew. And I was wondering if you could include a chapter on Freud's nephew who came to the U.S. and applied many of Freud's findings to advertising and then to the manufacturing of propaganda.
He was the guy who was the consultant to Woodrow Wilson's campaign, if I'm remembering correctly. Or are we talking about a different person?
Well, he's definitely
the one. Like in 1916, 1917, who helped Wilson come up with the whole concept of public relations in order to sell World War I to the American people?
I can't verify that, but I definitely know he's the one who sold cigarettes to the American public by having women smoke cigarettes in parades during the 20s.
Interesting.
So, Gene, I'll call you back with his name.
Yeah, I'll have to do a little homework on that. It's interesting. When I was in London giving a speech on attention deficit disorder back 10 years ago when one of my first books came out, and one of Freud's grandchildren was in the audience, and we had an interesting conversation afterwards about whether Freud himself had ADD. But that's a whole another topic. Gene, thank you for the call.
Hello?
Yes.
I want your book to bring all these wonderful things to free people and empower people. And
that's
right now, these psychological techniques are used to manipulate people.
Yeah, well, that's my goal, is to put all this stuff right out there where anybody can read it and also provides people with a certain level of insulation from it. Gene, thank you for the call. Rob in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Rob.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I love your show, and I'm really happy you're doing this thing.
Thank you.
On breaking the code. I think language is really important, and what I want to talk about is language of environmentalism.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've created a language for talking about nature that's kind of neglecting all these principles that you've been talking about. For instance, when we call nature the environment, we categorize it into something that people really can't picture, and it becomes a political category rather than a personal reference.
Well, the biggest mistake there is not the use of the word environment. It's the use of the word the. It's the objectification.
Right, objectified.
Instead, we should call it our environment.
Well, I even,
and that causes people to put themselves in the picture.
What about just calling it nature?
Well, nature can be objectified. That's nature out there. In fact, that's one of the sins or ills or problems or whatever of modern civilization is that we have separated ourselves from nature. We live in boxes. We drive in boxes. We very rarely experience nature as something that we're part of. So I would argue that it's better to say our environment, because environment has a double meaning. Right now, my environment is a radio studio. I'm surrounded by it. I'm also breathing the air in this studio. I'm experiencing the light in the studio. And that's my environment. But there's also the larger environment outside, which is, as you correctly described, Rob, you know, nature, the natural environment. And so cause people to think that the damage that they do to nature is impinging on their environment directly. In other words, if there's a smokestack down the street, some of that bad air is getting here into the studio. To the extent that we can cause people to have that association, that makes our environment an even more powerful positive association.
Well, I hear what you're saying, but I think we can go one step further and just realize that when we use the term environment, even if we say our environment, we're still objectifying by another degree something that is more readily understood just as nature.
Yeah. Well, again, I don't disagree, but I would point out again that nature is an objectification as well.
Yeah, and, to some degree, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the problem with language, and that's why you always want to try and bring people into it. And that's why I think the preposition is more important, the use of a preposition instead of an article. The, you know, bringing, you know, our environment, the nature in which we live. Right? See, that's the problem. Then trying to use nature starts to get kind of clunky. So I would encourage people, instead of saying the environment, to start saying our environment. Anyhow, Rob, thank you very much for your call. It's an interesting conversation and thought-provoking. We will we'll continue. I'll take more of your calls right after the break. 45 minutes past the hour. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi. Our telephone number, toll-free, 866-440-THOM. 440-8466. We'll be right back.
Trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And thanks so much to my producer David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Andrew Dunn and Lauren Kirshner, Alex Goldmark at Air America Radio, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society, RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. It is much appreciated. You make this program possible, and you make it work. Lauren, our call screener, who I just mentioned and thanked, says, a caller says Freud's nephew was Edward Bernays, and he was on a committee to sell World War I to the U.S. people. That's what I thought. That was my recollection. And then another caller, an English teacher, says, our is not, O-U-R, is not a preposition. It is a possessive pronoun. You're right. Thank you very much. My, you are invoking the memory of my mother, she's still alive, but the English major, would have gotten me on that right away. Anyhow, number 12 in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, number 12.
How you doing? I got to admit, I'm a bit rusty. I haven't done this in a couple of years, so I'm not really up to speed yet, but I appreciate you being back in my area here.
Well, thank you.
Anyway, I'd like to talk about demagoguery and specifically linguistics when it comes to gun control, one of my pet issues. And you were out of the market when the assault weapons ban, the quote assault weapons ban, expired in 2004. And it's the one thing that I will personally thank President Bush for. I can't stand everything else he's done, but he let that piece of Sarah Brady garbage expire, and I really thank him for it. And I think if that thing ever comes back again, it will be the Democrats shooting themselves in the feet again, because you're going to have a whole bunch of people who are conservative, like, you know, your gun show types, who are sick of George Bush, but they'll vote Republican just to vote against gun control.
Right.
And I think they need to give up their hate rhetoric, because it's these same people who are out there moaning and complaining about how their freedoms are being taken away, and they turn right around and saying, oh, we need to get rid of the Second Amendment.
Yeah,
and
the flip side of that, and you make a good point, number 12, and thank you for making it, and the flip side of that is the guy who called yesterday and said, I'm not committing any crimes. I don't care what the government does. They can listen in on anything I do. And so what I should have said, or I could have said to him at the time, was, great, why don't we just start registering all your guns? You know, if you've got a gun, you have to register it. And this was the ex-military guy, right? Good point. Richard in Seattle. And there's the whole thing of calling what is and what isn't an assault weapon, you know, all of that kind of... Yes, there's a huge amount of framing around the language of gun control, in quotes, and of assault weapons, in quotes. Richard in Seattle. Hey, Richard.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say once again, you convinced me you're the smartest tech in the Air America box. I've followed neurolinguistic program probably for... seems like a couple decades now when I first ran into Bendler and Grindler.
Mm-hmm.
And you never hear it talked about. As your caller a couple calls ago said, these are tools that everybody should have access to.
Yeah, I agree. I first started studying stuff in 1978 when I was the executive director of a residential treatment facility for severely emotionally disturbed kids. And the first psychologist that I hired was using it. And then over the years got trained in it, ended up being trained as a trainer. Richard Bandler was my trainer.
Really?
And wrote the foreword to one of my books, yeah.
I guess they're really curious characters. I would have loved to have met them.
Oh, yeah.
But Richard, I just wanted to point out, most of the NLP books are really very academic, very hard to dig into for the average reader. And since you're talking about NLP, I thought you might mention a couple titles like Frogs into Princes, you probably know.
Yeah, and The Structure of Magic.
The Structure of Magic, the two original books.
Yeah.
And then the other one by, I think it's by Bendler, is Using Your Brain for a Change.
Yes, and there's another one that I think the Andreas has wrote, Use Your Brain and Keep the Change. No, Change Your Mind and Keep the Change.
Yeah.
Words
like
effect.
That.
All these little cute little double entendres. There's also, you know, Core Transformation by Connie Ray and Steve Andreas, a brilliant book.
And a lot of other really good ones, but a lot of them start really getting more academic for the therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I mentioned, like, Frogs into Princes is a great example, because just about anybody can pick that one up and access some of the fundamental tools of neurolinguistic programming
Although you do need to read it a little slowly. But, yeah, good point, Richard.
Well,
I'm just
like, I have to read everything slowly.
There you go. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good talking with you. Bill, is it Beaumont, Illinois?
Yeah, hi Tom, how you doing?
Hey Bill, I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I'm the guy that called in about Bernays.
Oh, okay.
And anyway, also, Hitler, I don't know if he wrote this in Mein Kampf or not, but he said that if he had as good a propaganda as the Allies did in World War I, or if Germany did, then Germany would have won that war.
Oh, yeah, and that's why one of the very first things Hitler did was hook up with Goebbels and get that thing going. You're absolutely right. Propaganda was huge in the war. Alex in Scottsdale, thank you for pointing that out. Alex in Scottsdale, Arizona, we're just about out of time, Alex. Half a minute or so.
Well, you know, I'm just looking at what's employed in the psychological warfare they're using on Surge, and New Way, and Forward Again. You know,
yes.
The same thing over and over.
Well, and this whole thing, you're going to hear a lot of language next week when Bush does his State of the Union address. You're going to hear a lot of language about the future, and you're going to also hear an absolute conflation, a merging together of the occupation in Iraq and 9/11 and the so-called war on terror. He is not going to talk about the war on Iraq as a separate thing, or the occupation of Iraq as a separate thing. He's going to talk about it as the war on terror in an attempt to deliberately and further confuse Americans.
Well, you know, you look at the amount of bodies that are being...
Yeah, Alex, I'm sorry, your cell phone is breaking up there. But point well taken. Anyhow, coming up on Monday's program, top news of the day. Plus, I'll be debating George Landreth with the American Conservative Union, who says, when it comes to fighting and winning the war against an Islamic terrorist, liberal Democrats like Ted Kennedy and Nancy Pelosi seem more interested in symbolism than substance. Yeah, right. Plus, independent journalist Sarah Olson here about her, with a First Amendment alert about her being called to testify in the Wetata case. Have a great weekend, my friends, and don't ever forget, democracy and activism begin with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. 6 minutes past the hour. Miriam Grossman is with us, a psychiatrist at the University of California, Los Angeles, and the author as author, I don't know how you'd say that, as listed as anonymous where'd the book go here? A Unprotected, a campus psychiatrist reveals how political correctness in her profession engenders every student. Dr. Grossman, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's good talking with you again. You said now in your book, the polarization of opposite sexes and a binary gender system must be replaced by androgyny and alternative sexualities. What do you mean by that?
No, you've quoted that wrong.
Okay.
When I talk about that issue of the binary gender system, it's in the context of disagreeing with that and saying that there's an agenda out there in our culture and certainly on our campuses to to say that there is a spectrum between male and female, and that the idea of a distinct difference between male and female is incorrect. So I am saying that I disagree with that, and that that's an agenda that's infiltrated our campus health system. Is that any more clear?
Well, that's what I thought I meant to say, that you're suggesting that this binary gender system, which I believe is your phrase, is how it is.
Yes, and that's exactly right.
And
yes.
and that any kind of alternative sexualities and presumably homosexual behavior is something that should be what?
Well, yeah, you better be careful there, because I didn't make any judgment on homosexual behavior except when I'm speaking about anal intercourse, which is practiced by other people as well. A lot of young women are practicing anal intercourse to avoid pregnancy, and I go into the dangers of that. But I do not make judgments in terms of being attracted to the same sex and having sexual behavior with the same sex. So I don't know if you got another book there.
Yeah, no, I apparently, or a different review from the material that you were sending out. Because the sense that I got is that you're talking about how political correctness on campus is harming American women. In fact, the subtitle of your book, A Campus Psychiatrist Reveals How Political Correctness in a Profession Endangers Every Student. And you've come out, I mean, the main point here is that you've said that Nancy Pelosi's takeover of the House is going to harm American women. How?
Oh, boy. Where are you getting these things from? I'm going to have to talk to somebody.
I have a news release here from Sarah Huber, your publicist at Spence Publishing, that says Nancy Pelosi's takeover of the House may have broken the marble ceiling, but her plans for America harm women. A culture that exalts gender neutrality and offers abortion as a quick cure-all beats a quick path to physical, emotional, and spiritual destruction, warns UCLA psychiatrist Miriam Grossman, MD.
Oh, there we go. Okay, so there was a lot of stuff there in between the beginning and the end that you didn't say. Yes, a culture that glorifies having multiple partners and hookups, a culture that minimizes the effects for some people of an abortion and of STDs. Yeah, I think that's harmful to our young women.
And you're suggesting that Nancy Pelosi is an advocate of casual sex?
No.
Then why send out a news release that says you are?
Okay. Well, as you know very, very well, these news releases are not written by me, and they are in order to get the attention of people in any way possible.
Well, I'm assuming that you read it. I mean, when my publisher sends out news releases, I get to read them first.
Okay. Well, I don't read these things. I asked to, and I don't. But that's neither here nor there. I mean, I'm making some very, very salient points in my book, and you're using a press release that is not completely accurate to try and trip me up over here.
Well, I'm using the material that is being sent out in your name.
Okay,
I simply quoted it to you. And
what would you like to do right now, then?
Well, apparently you don't think that Nancy Pelosi represents a plan that will harm American women. The phrase in the press release.
I have nothing against Nancy Pelosi as a person. Someone, though, who is going to advocate the sort of culture that we have on our campuses, and many people are advocating that sort of culture, in particular certain websites that are from universities that are promoting the hookup culture. Yes, that is harming our young people.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree with you that a hookup culture is not a good thing.
Oh.
What I'm curious about is why you would blame what I suppose probably we could agree you might describe as cultural liberals, when it is the cultural conservatives who are removing sex education from our schools, particularly at a younger age where kids could be clearly informed about sexuality and about the dangers of inappropriate and inappropriately timed sexuality and how, you know, just the whole spectrum of that. And perhaps even more important, the corporations who are pushing a values-free consumeristic society. I mean, these are all conservatives who are promoting this kind of stuff that's leading to this behavior that you're decrying.
Okay. Okay, let me explain here. I am not blaming liberals or conservatives. I am saying that the health information that's out there, and most of the health information that's written, sexual health, that is coming from a point of view of early sex and assuming that there is going to be early sexual behavior. That is correct. There is very early sexual behavior in this country. What I'm complaining about is that it omits, that education that we're giving to the young kids omits and distorts certain information. For example, young girls have an immature cervix. The cervix matures as you get older and becomes tougher and less vulnerable to disease. All I want is for the sex information, the sex ed information, to include that very important and critical point that the younger you are, the more likely you are to get an STD.
Then why don't you take on the Jerry Falwells of the world who are suggesting that there should be no discussion of sexuality whatsoever to somebody who's 13 years of age or under?
I'm just writing about the information that needs to be out there, and whoever isn't giving that information is incorrect.
Okay, well, it's just you know, this is being, the headline of this news release was Nancy Pelosi's ascent is bad news for women. It's just, it seems rather political. Apparently you don't want it to be political. That's fine. Isn't this also about how families are fractured by the conservative economic policies that are destroying the American middle class? We have half of all American kids now coming home to an empty house.
My book has to do with science, anatomy, physiology. I'm really not an economics person, and I don't want to speculate mm-hmm. outside of my area of expertise.
I see. Okay. So your concern about politically correct medical treatment
right,
on campuses.
Right. I'll explain that. I believe that the reason why we're not giving all the information, for example, about a girl's cervix being immature is because then it will be admitting that young women are more vulnerable than young men. That's where the PC stuff comes in. I believe that we don't want to...
Who has ever suggested that kind of a discussion shouldn't take place? Outside of the Jerry Falwells of the world who don't want anything discussed about sexuality at all.
Oh, well, that's refreshing. But tell me where in sex ed it's going to point out to girls that they're more vulnerable than their boyfriends.
Well, if it's medically true, it absolutely certainly should.
Right, but it's not there.
Well,
the fact
of the matter is, there is, for all practical purposes, there isn't even sex ed in the United States anymore. I mean, it's being stripped out by people who have political agendas and largely oddly religious agendas, which you would think would want to protect women and young girls.
Well,
but
let me explain that. From a medical point of view, waiting as long as you can is the best choice. From a medical, not moral and not religious and all of that, but simply from a medical point of view.
Sure. So by all means, that information should be available to people.
It's given lip service. It's not something that's presented the same way you would present don't smoke, don't eat trans fats. It's not presented in that same manner.
Yeah, well, let's hope that it gets out there. Miriam Grossman, the author of Unprotected, A Campus Psychiatrist, reveals how political correctness in her profession endangers every student. Author Anonymous on Amazon. Miriam Grossman, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
16 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number if you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com. Click live chat, drop in and say hi. We'll be right back. Exposing the con and conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. Bob in San Jose, California. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Yeah, good morning. But I just heard something that absolutely blew me away. I mean, talk about a disconnect between a publisher and an author.
Well, it gets a little stranger. David Poole is my producer, and he's sitting here in the studio with me. And he told me that during the break something. David, I'm going to open your mic here. Did you talk with our guest before she came on the air?
Yeah, I did. And pre-interviewed her a little bit yesterday and this morning.
And her news release says that she was going to come on and talk about how Nancy Pelosi is bad. Is that what she told you?
That's what she told me, that the liberal agenda from the leader of the House was bad for women in the country.
In America. In as many words.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so there you go, Bob.
Wow. So who's telling the right story?
My guess is that if she had been on the Sean Hannity show, it would have been a very different interview.
Well, I could say one thing. If
Thank
the
you,
description
David.
She made of her book sounds like it's an academic book intended for academics, and a press release like that would not sell that book to any academics.
Yeah.
And the people who would buy it based on a press release would go about three pages in and say, God, what is this?
Yeah.
And put it down. I can't believe that would be a positive press release.
No, it's
I don't know. This is why I say maybe an interesting thing would be to follow up on how did this press release come to be? Because I'll bet there's more books being misrepresented like this.
I don't think the book is being misrepresented.
Really?
Yeah, no, the subtitle of the book is How Political Correctness on Campus. I mean, it's about politics.
Well, but she talked about that difference about, you know, men being treated exactly equal as women, and women actually are more vulnerable. Well, maybe that's where the little political correctness that I heard her talk about is, but gosh, there still seems like a big disconnect in publicity and publishing here.
Yeah, David.
As an author, I'm stunned she didn't read that press release first before it was released.
Yeah, David. You wanted to say something?
Yeah, just on a side note, she asked our call screener, Lauren, before she came on the air if this was a conservative or a liberal show. So she didn't do her research, I don't think, and she wasn't aware of really who she was going on the air with.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. Bob, I want to move along from the
topic.
Okay,
thank you.
It was an interesting one. It was definitely an interesting one. We have Pat Leahy going after Alberto Gonzalez here. It's certainly worth listening to.
We knew damn well if he went to Canada, he wouldn't be tortured. He'd be held, he'd be investigated. We also knew damn well if he went to Syria, he'd be tortured. And it's beneath the dignity of this country, a country that has always been a beacon of human rights, to send somebody to another country to be tortured.
Before you get more upset, perhaps you should wait to receive the briefing.
How long?
I'm hoping that we can get to the information next week.
Before you get more upset, I mean, how condescending can you get, Mr. Gonzalez? Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, Tom. I'm glad you played that audio because that's what I was going to bring up. I thought that was amazing by Senator Leahy. I mean, the whole point that people need to understand is that these are people that were found innocent. They were still sent to another country where they were originally from, but they were no longer citizens of that country. They knew they'd be tortured because, I don't know if you heard in the audio, Senator Leahy pointed out that we no longer talk to Syria because we don't trust them.
Right.
But yet we trust them enough to send somebody there not to torture them?
Right.
How does that make any sense?
And Pat Leahy, if he's not some, you know, hot-headed. I mean, Pat Leahy is a former federal prosecutor. He's an attorney. He has seen it all. He's a by-the-book, do-it-by-the-law guy. I don't want to say he's a conservative Democrat because, you know, he's fairly progressive on most social things. But when it comes to law and order stuff, you know, Pat Leahy is just, you know, a straight arrow guy. And what he's horrified about is that we are breaking the law. We are breaking international law. We here in the United States.
Yeah, Tom, I want to make two additional points to that. He also said towards the end that, our allies, Canada being one of our closest allies, are really upset about this. Because
yes.
They reviewed the information. I don't know if you heard the end of that audio. They reviewed the information that we had on this gentleman, and they found this guy to be not guilty of any crime.
Yeah.
So not only did we, you know, hold him for 10 months based on no information, we had him tortured in addition to that.
Right. And the guy was a Canadian citizen, which is why Canada's so upset. For our listeners who don't know what we're talking about here. Yeah.
Yeah, and Tom, I don't know if, did you hear the one where, I think it was Senator Leahy was talking about the war profiteering. He asked Mr. Gonzalez, in 5 years, why have you not prosecuted any corporations for war profiteering? Because they're creating legislation now, I don't know if you heard that, I think he's the one who's initiating this legislation which says if they overvalue any of the projects that they do there, you know, they will get prosecuted for it. And Mr. Gonzalez was unable to answer it. I mean, he kept going around the whole question. He kept saying, well, you know, it's difficult to prosecute fraudulent activity. And he's saying, but the Government Accountability Office has all this information. The press is reporting how Halliburton is overcharging taxpayers. How can you guys not get this information?
Right, and this is where the administration is just doing an incredible soft shoe on this because their buddies and their big campaign donors are the ones who are making the hundreds of billions of dollars in money that's coming out of your pocket and mine, Patricia. And that's the bottom line. That's where it's all coming from. And it's just absolutely wrong. I appreciate your call. We're going to have to take a break here in just a second, and we'll be back with more of your calls as a possibility, assuming he's not tied up in a house vote that Dennis Kucinich may give us a shout to. And we'll be back. We'll be back right after this here on the Radio Support Group of By and For We the People of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Telling the truth, that the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you. 34 minutes past the hour, and time now for a Rush Alert!
Condescending tribes making money selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts.
Hates his guts.
I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic guts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi. He's a Nazi.
That's right.
I really am, because I'm a Nazi.
He's a Nazi.
That's right.
You're being scammed.
I'm a Nazi.
He's a Nazi.
I don't care about the middle class, because I'm a fat conservative butthead with the face of a horse's ass.
He's a fat conservative butthead.
Hey,
with the face of a horse's ass.
Boom, our Rush Alert theme music. And now here, before I play for you our Rush Alert for the day, let me just give you just a little background. This is from the BBC, a nice summary of the history of cannabis, and they talk about how in 1916 to 1937, William Randolph Hearst sold lots of newspapers using stories about colored men using marijuana to corrupt white women. Okay, you got that? This now from yesterday's Limbaugh program.
Nobody wants to criticize him because he's above criticism. He's a godlike figure to the godless. You don't...
The he, by the way, he's talking about is Mr. Obama, Barack Obama.
Criticize gods or godlike figures. What if the whole anti-smoking bunch has to come out, because they're a bunch of libs too, has to find a way to justify Obama's coolness? Because he's got fire. If he's got fire in his hands, what has he got in his pants?
Yeah, I think that an old con is being played out again. And tragically. Dennis Kucinich on the line with us. Dennis Kucinich, welcome to the program.
Tom, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm fine. It's been a while since we've talked, and I'm it's great to have you back on the program. I'm curious about I've been hearing about your promoting a return to the fairness doctrine, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, and perhaps share with you mine.
Well, sure. Let's step back a minute though, so you understand how that question arose. I have just been named the chairman of the Domestic Policy Subcommittee of Government Oversight. This is a subcommittee that has probably the broadest reach of any subcommittee in the federal government, because it has jurisdiction over every department of the federal government with the exception of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense, and also of every federal regulatory agency and of many boards and commissions. So in the course of a discussion about the role of the media, I had mentioned at a conference that the committee that I now chair will look at the implications of the fairness doctrine having been canceled about 20 years ago, and what has that meant for this country, and are there any implications for changes in policy?
And okay, so I was working in radio back when we had the fairness doctrine. Back in the late 60s and early 70s. I started in radio in 1968. And the station that I did news at for 7 years had an afternoon talk show. And we were hysterically careful about, if we have politician A on, we have to have politician B on. If topic A is discussed, topic B is discussed. And 9 times out of 10, as a consequence of that, we didn't talk about politics. We talked about the lawn and garden show. And I'm concerned, frankly, that if we were to bring back the fairness doctrine, that it could bring about, as much as it might bring about some kind of balance in the airwaves, it could also kill political talk radio.
Well, you know, the Red Line decision of the Supreme Court in 1969 really laid the basis for the First Amendment's role in the broadcast media by saying there has to be multiplicity of views. And I'm not trying to say that come down on one side or another, except that the FCC Act of 1934 said that the broadcast media has to perform in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. The Red Line decision pointed out the urgency of broadcast licensees making sure that that there's an attempt to provide diverse views.
Right.
Now, I want to find out is that happening absent the fairness doctrine? And I know that there's a great concern that during the war, in some of the early years of the war, that voices opposed to the war weren't really being given much attention at all. In one study of 393 news segments about the war, only three were from people who were opposed to the war. This is really about diversity of views.
Yep.
And it's not about trying to deny people access to their point of view. It's
right.
Exactly.
I wonder, Congressman Kucinich, if there's a larger issue here at work. Frankly, this is my take on it, and that is that we need to apply the Sherman antitrust doctrine to the media, rather than relocalize our media, rather than try to by government fiat regulate its content. That might be so.
In the last 20 years or so, the media companies have shrunk from 50 to 6 major media companies. And what that means is that there's a greater concentration, and the consolidation has brought with it a whole new host of problems. And so, the issues of consolidation are another thing that need to be looked at, because the First Amendment doesn't belong to any corporation. It belongs to all of us. The airwaves are owned by the public. They're not owned by any particular individual or corporation. So how in 2007 does all that come down? My committee is going to be asking the questions, and with the help of people in the broadcast industry, as well as people who work in media reform, I think that perhaps we could take a look that could be healthy for the debates in the country about the role of the media.
Yeah, I agree that we need to be having this discussion. I think it's a very important one, and
that's what I'm doing, Tom. I think it's a chance to restart the discussion. But keep in mind that this committee has such broad jurisdiction. This is only one of hundreds of matters that we might be looking into. So I'm. It was interesting, though, just to have a brief mention of the fairness doctrine, to see the tremendous response that we received.
It is going to cause everybody in talk radio, I tell you, to sit up and take notice. We're talking with Dennis Kucinich. Kucinich.us, his website, a prospect for president in 2008, congressman from Ohio's 10th district. Congressman Kucinich, defunding the Iraq occupation. What are your thoughts on this?
I'm sorry?
What are your thoughts on defunding the Bush's so-called surge, or for that matter, the entire occupation?
Tom, you know, I led the effort in challenging the war years ago in the House of Representatives. I organized 125 Democrats to vote against the war.
Yep.
As a candidate for president, I'm in it to make sure that the Democratic Party takes this country in a new direction, not just opposed to this war, but using war as an instrument of policy. Now, what I've said is this, that we have to not just oppose the surge, but, there are many members of Congress who are saying, well, I'm not for the surge, but I'm for the occupation. We're going to have to finish the job. we need to oppose the occupation. There are members of Congress who have said, well, you know, I don't like this war, but I'm going to have to vote to continue funding it. I'm saying that if someone opposes the war, it's not credible to say you oppose the war and continue to fund it. So I've taken a strong stand in offering members of Congress a plan. It's a 12-point plan that enables us to get out of Iraq, stabilize Iraq, reemerge as a participant in the world community. It's on my website at Kucinich.us, and it's the only plan that exists that will enable us to exit from Iraq, and with the cooperation of the administration, we can really begin a new chapter in this what has been a very tragic experience for the United States and the world.
Yeah, in a very real way, George Bush has opened the gates of hell. It's Dennis Kucinich, we only have about a minute left here before we have to take a break. I'm curious, what as a candidate for president of the United States, what do you see as the largest issue facing America right now?
Our ability to work cooperatively with the world to create peace and then thereby share the benefits that come from peace, which are prosperity. We can't meet the needs of our own people here at home with respect to housing, education, health care, because the war is siphoning off all these revenues. But more than that, we've set the basis for continuing war. There's talk of an attack on Iran. My leadership in the Congress, in my presidency, will be about a whole new role for America in the world, rejecting war as an instrument of policy, working cooperatively with the world community on matters relating to international security. You know, envisioning a world that where people can work cooperatively to address matters of security and global climate change and imbalance in trade and human rights and workers' rights and the environment. I mean, we can have the world that we want. The people are ready.
We can do it. We have to wrap it up. I'm sorry. Dennis Kucinich, Kucinich.us, the website. Congressman, thanks so much for being here with us.
Tom, let's talk again soon. Bye.
I look forward to it. I do. 45 minutes past the hour.
Oh, please, Mr. President, I voted for you. Not just one time, either. I think it was two. I like the way you said that you would throw away the key. But there's been some kind of error. They came to get me. I need to call a lawyer to straighten this out. No one in here knows or cares what I'm talking about. When we threw out that habeas corpus and those trials you see, wasn't that for the bad guys, not the good guys like me? Oh, please, Mr. Prison Guard, don't beat me again. Can't you see in other circumstances we could be friends? Won't you let me call my lawyer? I can call him at home.
I ain't one of them bad guys.
Protesters, they all hate the U.S.
Yeah, those terrorists and protesters, they all hate the U.S., but not me. Hey, how come I'm in jail? What?
Welcome back. It's the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman radio program. Before Congressman Kucinich came on, I was sharing with you our Rush alert. Limbaugh doing his whole, our Obama's pants on fire. And I pointed out that back in 1916 and 1937, William Randolph Hearst and the Reefer Madness, this whole thing about African Americans and pot and white women. The point was, and I should have taken an extra minute to make it, but Dennis was on the line wanting to get him on. Limbaugh is talking about Obama smoking cigarettes. But the point is that he then shifts that into sexuality. And I'm just... And I suspect that what we're seeing is a replay. There's just this full court press going on to take down Barack Obama by the Republicans. And in fact, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service with us. Hey, Victoria.
Well, what about his sexuality?
Well, this is the tail end of this quote from Limbaugh yesterday.
Has to find a way to justify Obama's coolness because he's got fire. If he's got fire in his hands, what has he got in his pants?
Yeah, because he smokes cigarettes. And not mentioning that Laura Bush smokes cigarettes, too. And then on top of that, I just got this. This is from Insight Magazine. This has gone out to all the talk show hosts all over the country and, you know, just boom, you know, the old mass right-wing machine. Headline, Hillary's team has questions about Obama's Muslim background. Now, keep in mind, this is not coming from Hillary Clinton's campaign. This is coming from a right-wing website. Are the American people ready for an elected president who was educated in a madrasa as a young boy and who has not been forthcoming about his Muslim heritage? This is the question Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton's camp is asking about Senator Barack Obama. An investigation of Mr. Obama by political opponents within the Democratic Party has discovered that Mr. Obama was raised as a Muslim by his stepfather in Indonesia. Sources close to the background check, however, which has not been released, said Mr. Obama, 45, spent at least 4 years in a so-called madrasa or Muslim seminary in Indonesia. He was Muslim, but he concealed it, the source said. His opponents within the Democrats hope this will become a major issue in the campaign. And then, you know, it goes on to, you know, et cetera.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I do not think, frankly, that this is coming out of Hillary Clinton's campaign or anything close to it. Although, now the conservatives have got me wondering, I don't know, what are your thoughts on this?
It's possible it's coming out from somebody in her campaign. I mean, they do have people doing negative research on other people.
Yeah.
And they're pretty vicious.
But then leaking it through a right-wing source, through Insight Magazine?
I find that extremely unlikely, because yeah. I wouldn't have thought they'd want to leak it. They want to keep it to themselves until they use it themselves.
Yeah, and slam him at the last
minute. Right, now is not the time to use it. I mean, it's a waste of your ammunition.
So maybe Hillary Clinton's opposition research team has been infiltrated by cons.
Well, that's possible, too. Or else the whole thing was just not done that way.
Yeah.
And it really wasn't Hillary Clinton's research team.
Interesting. Yeah, and that's the other possibility, is that this is just pure disinformation.
That's exactly possible.
Yeah, and in fact, it goes on to say, in two best-selling autobiographies, The Audacity of Hope and Dreams from My Father, Obama, born in Honolulu, where his parents met, mentions but does not expand on his Muslim background, alluding only to his attendance at a, quote, predominantly Muslim school, end quote. And the sources say the young Obama was given the name Hussein by his Muslim father, which the Illinois Democrat rarely uses in public.
So because he doesn't expand on it, because he comes clean and is forthright and forthcoming and mentions it, they go after him because he doesn't like write a whole chapter about it.
Yeah, I find this amazing. And what's even more amazing is that there is still very little discussion in the mainstream media about Barack Obama's positions on the issues and Hillary Clinton's positions on the issues, if these two are considered the main front runners. Dennis Kucinich is in the race. We know his positions on the issues. I just had him on the program a few minutes ago. He's absolutely unambiguous. He's right out there. Let's talk about the issues, but it ain't going to happen. Anyhow, we have about a minute before we have to wrap up the hour, Victoria. What's going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, the other thing is one of the things that you were alluding to in the song, which is, of course, this new manual that the Pentagon came out with yesterday, the day that the Senate Judiciary was holding hearing with Alberto Gonzalez, the AG. This is the new manual describing what you can and can't do with terrorism suspects when it comes to trials. And they basically seem to be saying, well, here's the new song, same as the old song.
Right. If you, Victoria Jones, or if I, Tom Hartman, were to be charged with a terrorist act by President Bush, then suddenly we lose all of our rights. People can be tortured to testify against us. That a testimony can be entered in secret. We have no right to cross-examine them. It can be based on hearsay, and we can be put to death based on that information.
And this will be challenged in the courts, and the Democrats are going to be working to overturn some of these things. Certainly habeas corpus, you've got Senators Leahy and Specter working on that right now.
Yeah, this should be more than simply overturned. This needs to be repudiated. I mean, there needs to be at the right across the board in America. Americans need to stand up and say, this is not what America stands for. This is the antithesis, the opposite of what America stands for. These guys are absolutely un-American. In fact, they are traitors to America if they're trying to turn us into that kind of a country. Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thanks for coming on today.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. After the news, we're going to be talking about I'll be writing on the air again our book, Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. We're going to be talking about future pacing. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.